This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscoane. Edward O. Wilson is one of the world's preeminent biologists who has made enormous contributions to our understanding of evolution. He's also a leading authority on ants and won a Pulitzer Prize for his book titled simply The Ants. Wilson was a proponent of something called kin selection in human evolution. People who are related will act selflessly because of their bond with each other, their shared genes. He now says the connection between genetic relatedness and altruism doesn't tell the whole story. E.O. Wilson writes in his new book, The Social Conquest of Earth, that group selection is the dominant evolutionary force that can explain a wide range of behaviors. He also says there is much we can learn from ants, termites, wasps, and bees. E.O. Wilson, it's been a number of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
So to be honest with you, I wasn't sure where to begin, but let's begin with ants, bees, termites, and wasps. These are EU societies. Help us understand what these insects, what they can tell us about ourselves.
Yeah, my
ignorance is totally on display here, but go ahead.
Let's assume that some of this will be unfamiliar anyway to the audience. And EU means agreeable, gentle, whatever, but it also means real. So we say eusocial for real, which means that it's that level of social behavior which is characterized by cooperation based upon altruistic behavior among the individuals, some of whom are willing to give up a little bit of their lifespan or the amount of reproduction they do. This has occurred, by my count, some 24 times in the history of life. It's a very rare occurrence. It does occur in some insects, ants, bees, wasps, termites, but also in some marine crustaceans and a few other examples of the evolution of social behavior in the animal kingdom as a whole. Now, in taking these into account, and surprisingly, this hasn't been done hardly at all with reference to humans because of the perception we have that humans are so elevated, you know, up to demigod status, that we don't bear description with animals. And yet, we do use lower organisms to understand ourselves.
Well, as you say, even at the very beginning of your book, we struggle to see our connection to apes, much less our connection to bees, wasps, termites, and what you have just been talking about.
Well, that's true, but consider that the lowly E. coli, which is that bacterium in your gut, was used to get the major understandings we have had on a great deal of molecular genetics of human beings, and that a little roundworms called Caenorhabditis were the animal creatures used to understand how nervous systems are put together. So what I have done is to go to lower organisms to see what really caused the rise of eusociality, and it fits together very well.
Well, let me just pick up on that, because what you're talking about are traits that have helped maybe a nest or a community. So there's cooperation, there's the divvying up of work, and there's also this ability to communicate, whether it's through chemicals or the way you and I are talking with each other.
That's right. And most of the creatures in the world, including most of these insects, it's all chemical.
And that's how they talk with each other. But that's what we share. So we cooperate, we work together, and we communicate in one form or another.
Yes,
these are eusocial societies.
Most importantly, we have the vision of labor based on altruism.
Right. Yeah. Now, going back, then this is where I guess you have broken with not just yourself, but also with other people, the idea that kin selection was our way of understanding not just human evolution, but also altruism, why people would self-sacrifice for the good of their gene pool.
That's right, their immediate relatives. Actually, the idea was that if you have a group of kin, close kin together, then you've created the conditions under which eusociality can arise. Because if you were to sacrifice yourself a little bit, you know, to cooperate with kin and give up a little. And the kin benefited by more than a compensating amount by through the increase of the genes that you share with the kin by your common ancestry. You know, if you're brother, sister, you have half your genes shared. That then that's the way altruism would arise, and that's the way societies could form, with enough aggregation and enough of that occurring. So kin selection, I just said what it was, was seen for a long time as the key to the whole thing. It didn't really explain that much, but it was there was a faith that this is what we would eventually use to explain everything. But after 40 years, and I was one of the first promoters.
I know you were.
It just was spinning its wheels, and it was not working very well, and there were a lot of things against it. So thus I came, and others came back to, not so much back, but we renewed a whole different approach that had been jettisoned, and that would include evolution to an advanced degree by group versus group, group selection. If you're in a group, and you cooperate in that group, and you're altruistic in that group, then that group can defeat other groups, even though it's made up of selfish individuals. That's the basic idea.
Well, maybe we could take a workplace. I mean, here we are where I work. We're part of a group. We have – everyone has largely different roles, but nonetheless, the mission is the thing that draws us all together. Yeah. Are we an example of a youth society?
Well, in a lesser and more diffuse sense,
right.
In that you belong to other groups as well. But there are primary groups of affiliation that you have that actually you could put the term tribe on. Humanity is divided into tribes. They're fluctuating, they're dividing, they're growing with alliances. They're growing by coercion, and they're growing especially around the world by common religious faith. And by that I mean they share the same creation story. And those who have the same creation story believe in general that they also, therefore, through their leaders, have the voice of God and the direction and the favor of God. And that's the source of a lot of trouble. But that's probably the best illustration of tribal divisions in modern human life.
Well, something that you wrote here, I'm quoting from your book, a group selection shapes instincts that tend to make individuals altruistic toward one another, but not towards members of other groups. Individual selection is responsible for much of what we call sin, while group selection is responsible for the great part of virtue. Together, they have created the conflict between the poor and better angels of our nature. You're saying, in a sense, human beings have warring instincts.
This is what's really new about the renewal of this more complex theory of, you know, two levels of natural selection, group versus group, tending to engender cooperation and altruistic behavior. And many of the things that we consider to be morally superior and hard to understand versus the competition that goes on in the old-fashioned Darwinian state within groups. And so the fact is that we are a kind of chimera.
Meaning?
We have genes that predispose us to the one and were shaped by the evolution occurring at the individual level versus genes that were engendered by group selection that predispose us to the other. So where are we? We are conflicted as a species. We're caught in between. If we went in one direction all the way to individual level selection, the society would dissolve. If we went all the other way to complete cooperation and complete and altruism, then we would be sort of robotic angels. We would be like ants, actually. So the human
doing our job.
Well, the human condition then is to be conflicted in this manner. An important lesson to be learned, if this is correct, and I think it is the correct view of the human condition, is that we are wasting our time if we think that there is an ideal political system, religion, ideology, economic system. We just sort of have to snuffle our way on through history.
Well, that's so depressing. I mean, but doesn't evolution say that we get better over time, that we improve the species over time?
We're unique in that we have that high intelligence.
We do.
That allows us to complicate and elaborate individual interactions within the group and also between groups to the point where, no, we will never go to one extreme or the other.
So we're caught between these competing forces in a way?
Sure.
Evolutionary forces?
But that's what makes us both creative and interesting. I mean, if you think about it, the humanities, including fiction, the creative arts, are born out of that conflict. The humanities work within a rather narrow field of elaborations, endless permutations on interrelations among individuals that really interest us because they are in that conflict area.
Let me quote something from the very beginning of your book, page one. You write, "We have created a Star Wars civilization with Stone Age emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technology. We thrash about. We're terribly confused by the mere fact of our existence and a danger to ourselves and to the rest of life."
That sums it up.
That's a pretty, I'm not sure if that's a pessimistic, but a gritty view of human beings.
It shouldn't be, because so much of human creativity comes out of that ferment, including ambition, the right kind of ambition, the intense desire to do something new, to find something better, to express our own feelings, to express the group feelings. If we were really unified by a single ideology, mm-hmm. if we really went the direction of extreme cooperation, that is, we were designed only by group selection, then we would be a pretty dull species.
We're almost about a break here, but, you know, in this country, we, not everybody, but we kind of pride ourselves on being highly individualistic. I'm not sure that's true, but it's the mythology, I think.
Yeah, it is true. I mean, the American genius was to find the combination, the right combination of group loyalty and all of the better feelings coming from that, high level of moral standards to deal with individual, and then individualism with a high level of creativity.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation, talking with Edward O. Wilson about his new book called The Social Conquest of Earth. He has written more than 25 books, has received 2 Pulitzer Prizes, among many other honors and awards. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Margaret Kuo. Sunday, April 29th, I'll host a Madame Butterfly dinner. Miss Butta, formerly of New York City Opera, will perform selections from Puccini's masterpiece and traditional Japanese numbers. Margaret Kuo, support WHYY.
The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY. Do your drinking habits cause problems in your personal or professional life? Do you drink to cope with stress? These may be signs of alcohol dependence. UPenn is conducting a research study using naltrexone, an FDA-approved medication for use in treating alcoholism. If you are 18 or older, have an alcohol problem, and want to reduce your drinking, you may qualify for the study. Details at 215-222-3200, extension 170. 215-222-3200, extension 170.
I'm Marty Moscowane. We're featuring 2 Pulitzer Prize winners on Radio Times today who couldn't be more different, a 24-year-old crime reporter and an 82-year-old biologist. We present a wide variety of topics and guests on Radio Times, and that's why you listen. So why not make a pledge of support, especially if you've never been a member of WHYY? It's the second day of the spring membership drive. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. Pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks.
Supporting WHYY Bosch Thermotechnology, manufacturer of geothermal heat pumps that use the constant temperature of the earth to heat and cool homes. More information at boschgeo.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with biologist Edward O. Wilson, E.O. Wilson. He's got a new book. It's called The Social Conquest of Earth. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Here's a global question for you, but I think it's kind of embedded in what you've been writing here, which is how do we get to where we are today? And the sense I got from you is a lot of happy accidents or some lucky things that happened to the human species.
We know exactly what happened.
We do know. Good.
It's one of the basic questions, a pair of questions that biologists have never addressed, nor anthropologists, anybody else I know, is first, why is eusocial behavior so rare? It's only occurred, maybe that we're aware of, about two dozen times in the history of life. And the other is, why did it take so long for the people to show up? And even social insects, they didn't show up, any of them, until the Mesozoic, the age of dinosaurs. And the answer is pretty clear, and this is why it was so valuable for me to look at the history of all these species. That's what I do.
Yes, you know, I know that.
And the sequence of events that led up in every one of the 24 instances or so is identical. And it's we had to go through a series of steps which led up to finally the crucial channel or a threshold, and that is when a group builds a nest, or a solitary individual originally, or a loosely organized group, or a mated pair, builds a expensive nest that's defended from which individuals go out to get food, bring it back, to feed growing young and raise the young all the way to maturity. When you have that condition, and it's widespread, it's relatively uncommon, but it's widespread, now you have the opportunity to take the final step over. If the young stay with you, you have the beginnings of a eusocial society. That is true of all the couple dozen instances of which we have record and can retrace what happened without exception. And we find that it occurred in humans as well when you look at the human record.
The idea, obviously, nest related to ants or wasps.
Sure.
Human beings, our nest is what our home, our community, even our country.
Oh, yes. We're highly elaborated now, but the original step was taken about 3 million years ago during the Haboline period leading up to Homo erectus, which is our immediate ancestor. And we don't have it exactly documented, but we know it happened by Homo erectus times, 1.5 million to 2 million years ago, that's when one line of these Australopith predecessors started eating a lot of meat and capturing prey, and then they formed campsites, and they came to control fire. It was that point, 3 million years or so ago, that the brain went from the chimp level, all just soared up, one of the fastest growths of any evolutionary growths of any complex organ in the history of life. So it looks as though that human beings obey or are consistent. Our history is consistent with that of all the other eusocial creatures.
So we are at our base tribal. Yes.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, and we shouldn't be embarrassed by that, right? Apologize for that?
Actually, no. Not unless you want to get rid of your local football team and all of the fury and sound and joy and despair that go in the team sports. And, of course, we know how powerful war has been and how universal it's been all the way back as far as can be traced by the paleontologist. That we've always been tribal, group versus group. And what created us, of course, is also one of our greatest risk factors, is that we can now, with the kind of weaponry we have, destroy ourselves rather easily.
Obviously, having that capability to do that, I'm also thinking of the environment, which is that we are living in an environment and we are testing the limits of that environment as we live in it.
We've tended always to spread out as a species, and we've so been so successful since the Neolithic, you know, about 10,000-12,000 years ago, that we began to be, we invented agriculture about 8 times in mm-hmm. different parts of the world, of removing the natural environment and planting a small number of species that we feed on, allowing us to multiply rapidly in numbers. And that was so advantageous that we can't get over the habit. I mean, we can't really rein ourselves in enough even just to keep some little part of the rest of life. We are wiping it out.
Let me go back to that sentence I quoted where you say individual selection is responsible for much of what we call sin. What do you mean by that? Give us an example of that.
It's the product that an individual level selection that come from that, that include between individual competition. Not just healthy competition, as in sports right. or in seeing who can do the best in different areas of productivity, but also in dominance relations, in trickery, in gain an advantage by deception, in betrayal, in weakness of doing the right thing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which is really products of individual level selection. And we counter that in our, and we know increasingly the parts of the brain where this is countered by the better instincts that give us an innate sense of morality and make it easy for us to learn more altruistic traits as part of a personal code of morality and even of honor. So that's in contest with our desires, and it's intuitively clear, really, when you think about it that way, to take care of ourselves and our immediate offspring.
Well, and this, as you say, group selection is responsible for the great part of virtue, but I'm thinking how groups can also be very unvirtuous, and in fact, immoral. I'm thinking about the Nazis. I mean, that's the most obvious example of that.
Tribalism gone amok. Well,
indeed.
When you say virtue, I mean within the group.
Oh, within the group. So yes. the group takes care of each other or themselves.
Exactly.
Right.
And they manage through their creation stories, whether they are about, the gods creating us, or the perfect ideologies, which was the curse of the, what they thought to be the ultimate ideology, the curse of the 20th century, either one, allows one tribe to say that it must, for the good of humanity, obey mm-hmm. God's will, or take humanity in the direction of what everybody knows is the perfect ideology. And that's what just about tore the world apart, and particularly in the 20th century.
Indeed, indeed. But are you also saying that religion is a product of evolution?
Oh, very much so. Religion is a natural response to our perception of mortality to start with. It includes, I think it's a very broad canvas that mm-hmm. religious belief is painted upon. And I'm not referring to what we call spiritual values of, say, theological search for the astral, for the beyond, for a hope or a belief in God or the hope for afterlife. I'm not referring to that. I'm referring to the creation stories. Every tribe has a creation story. Every organized religion has a creation story. And unfortunately, there are hundreds of them, and they all differ from the next. They can't all be right. No two can be right. And not a one of them comes anywhere close, having been created in very long ago and set in stone. None of them come close to the realities that we now understand mm-hmm. made the world, made humanity, and govern our behavior toward each other today.
But do you think that this group selection is part of that attraction then to a particular religion? And yes, they have their own creation stories, and oftentimes believing that their creation story is the correct one.
They all do that. All religions, organized religions, believe their creation story is the correct one. And it's a little harsh to say that a certain religious belief with its own creation, because of that creation story, is by necessity bigoted.
Mm.
But it is.
But why do you say that? I mean,
but because there is a sense that it's superior. It can talk about cooperation, interfaith activities. It can talk about virtue toward others and toward other groups, which, of course, was the heart of what was the original Christian ideal. But then very quickly, it's transmogrified under stress into tribal aggression, the ancient instrument of human evolution brought back again.
And that's E.O. Wilson, Edward O. Wilson, our guest today on Radio Times. And he is a university research professor emeritus and honorary curator in entomology at Harvard University. He's the author of more than 25 books, has received the Pulitzer Prize 2 times, I believe I have that correct, and other awards as well. And he's got a brand new book called The Social Conquest of Earth. And we are talking about some of his ideas in that book. A number of decades ago, he was a proponent of something called kin selection. Now, in this book, he raises questions about that and offers an idea about group selection as the dominant evolutionary force that can explain a whole host of human behaviors. He also says we have a lot in common with ants and termites, wasps, and bees. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. As you're talking, I'm thinking about what I've heard evolutionary psychologists talk about.
Yeah.
And I think people that understand human nature talk about that tension between wanting to be an individual, mm-hmm. wanting to go out in the world, being part of a family, resisting part of the family. And it sounds like in evolutionary terms, you're mirroring some of what I've heard in psychological terms.
Well, actually, one of the attractions of taking this multi-level approach, that is, that we really were created by group selection, with all of its attendant horrors when group went against group and continue to do so, that really, for the first time, makes sense out of what we all know to be true about human behavior. Kin selection never did. Kin selection seemed to explain a few things about human behavior, but marginally, and then it appeared to be good enough to be applied to social insects. But in our critique, mine with two mathematicians in the article in Nature in,
yes.
18 months ago, we showed that it was mathematically unsound, the assumptions of kin selection, and we showed that case by case it was much better to use individual selection or individual and group selection combined. And that's where it is now. That critique has never been actually answered. The only response is really, to my knowledge, up to this point, and I'm always willing to listen, but up to this point have been statements that, well, kin selection work better than you say and so on, but it doesn't. It's mathematically unsound to start with.
And I'm not here to hold up that end of the argument, but I did notice that, you know, Richard Dawkins has criticized this, Jerry Coyne. I mean, these are pretty well-known evolutionary scientists like yourself, and they are pushing back.
Well, Richard Dawkins is not a scientist. I mean, he's... he hasn't really rarely publishes in peer review articles. That's not to denigrate him, but just simply to say, no, this is not another scientist pointing back. And Jerry Coyne, of course, I've heard from him because he's very outspoken. This is not his field at all, social behavior, evolution, or whatever, which means that we, in contrary, are getting strong support for this approach from many evolutionary biologists, including increasingly the younger generation and people who work in other aspects of social behavior. And these include several of the leading experts on that particular subject, eusocial behavior in animals.
I do want to get to our callers, but where did Charles Darwin come down? I mean, this debate came after him, but nonetheless, does he help guide some of your thinking?
You know, it's rather remarkable that Charles Darwin, in The Descent of Man, let me back up for just a moment.
Sure.
I'll be brief here. Charles Darwin was stumped by the ants when he was writing The Origin of Species, the great master work. And he said, if I can't understand how ant workers can create other ant workers, and they don't breed, but the character for being an ant worker is spread throughout the world, then this could be fatal to the theory of evolution by natural selection. So he finally figured it out with his theory of the well-flavored vegetable, which is essentially group selection. And the workers are part of a colony, and the colony is the unit of selection, and he got it right. When Bert Holdobler and I published a book called The Superorganism about 5 years ago, what we did was to lay out the splendid examples and rays of elaborate caste system, which could be explained in no other way by group selection, despite the fact that those who were defending kin selection were rejecting group selection. Huh. Darwin, in The Descent of Man, then took the next step. And he did say, in effect, that group versus group was a key to understanding the origin of many of the properties, including the best properties, of social behavior in humans. So he said it, and the man, darn him, he was so seldom wrong. He did say it, but the fact that he said it doesn't mean, you know, that we couldn't come up with something better. But what we have come up with, and I feel very confident of, actually matches what Darwin had in mind.
Interesting. We're about a minute away from our second break here. I'm looking at a headline from Bloomberg, and it says, Wilson says, greedy people, altruistic groups win. I mean, in a nutshell, is that, and I know it's much more complicated than that, but is that helpful for us to understand?
You can use a simple formula here. It's oversimplified, but it's the main drift of it is correct.
Yes.
In a selfish individuals beat altruistic individuals within groups. Right. Groups of altruists beat groups of selfish individuals.
Because why?
Because the ones made up of altruists are sacrificing to each other. They may be even competing to some extent. But because they can lay aside their own selfish interest and have a moral code and a code of honor and solidarity, even if it's based, say, on a creation story, they perform better. They are willing to work in unison, to cooperate in inventiveness and weaponry and in battle.
Let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Actually, want to get our callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Talking with acclaimed biologist Edward O. Wilson, E.O. Wilson, the author of many, many books, including a new one called The Social Conquest of Earth. A couple open lines. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Simon Rattle returns to the Philadelphia Orchestra to conduct Brahms's Third Symphony, plus the Rhenish Symphony of Brahms's friend and mentor, Robert Schumann, plus music of Brahms's disciple, Anton Weber. Tickets available at philorc.org, by phone at 215-893-1999. This Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Kimmel Center, Simon Rattle conducts Brahms and Schumann with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
I'm Marty Moscowane. It's the second day of the spring membership campaign. Have you made a pledge of support yet? Since you listen to WHYY, you owe it to yourself to be a supporter to ensure the future of in-depth news and analysis. You decide what that's worth and then make a call. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY, or you can pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase Cancer Center and Fox Chase Cancer Center Buckingham have been awarded 3-year terms of accreditation in radiation oncology by the American College of Radiology and the American Society for Radiation Oncology. This accreditation represents Fox Chase's commitment to the high level of quality, patient safety, and technical rigor as specified by national experts in the field. More at foxchase.org and foxchase.org/Buckingham. Fox Chase Cancer Center, hearts plus minds.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, I'm talking with award-winning and acclaimed biologist Edward O. Wilson, E.O. Wilson. And he's got a new book called The Social Conquest of Earth. And we have just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get, looks like Rick from Florence, New Jersey to join us. And Rick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks for having my call.
You're welcome.
Real quick question. I prescribe pretty wholly to the Darwinism theory of the selfish gene. And I'm wondering if you were to take the family tree backwards and work from there, at what point in time do you feel that the group becomes more important? At what point in time do you feel like, you know, you start giving of yourself or you start giving of the group more so than of your own selfish desires?
I mentioned it a little bit earlier that it happens between 3 and 2 million years ago when we shifted the line leading up, the Haviline, apparently, that forerunner group, began to shift toward hunting and prey and then formed a campsite. And then, like the other two dozen or so lines in the history of life that went to eusocial with that kind of cooperation, this catapulted us into group selection.
And just to make sure our listeners understand, when you talk about or when Rick talks about a selfish gene and others have as well.
That's confusing.
Well, it is.
There's two meanings to that. I'll be very brief. The original Darwinian, that's correct, view is that really genes are propagating genes, although the target of collection, of selection, can be traits of either the individual or the group. When I think that term was used, actually I used it first, before Dawkins.
Oh, you're such a troublemaker.
I know it. Well, I used it, well, not really. I just used it metaphorically, even before Dawkins. It was used then to accentuate kin selection, that you were being generous to others, providing they were kin because of the kin effect. But now we've had to jettison that particular meaning of it.
Right. But the idea also, I think for some people, the notion of the selfish gene is also an explanation of the survival of the fittest, which is, you know, I'm going to survive. I'm being very metaphoric here. I'm going to survive, and if you're in my way, I'll take you out.
That would be the product of pure individual-level selection. But you know there's a burning car out there, and there's somebody you never met who's in danger. You'll go and risk your life, and you'll pull that person out. That's group selection.
Yeah. We see that in the military, right? It seems to me that's a good example.
The band of brothers. They're not brothers, but they will, in so many aspects, in so many situations, sacrifice even their lives. And many a Medal of Honor, Congressional Medal of Honor, has been given to men, especially in war in our country, who did it. And you can only admire it. It's an enormous sacrifice.
But just to underscore that, when in terms of evolution, they don't have shared genes, right?
None.
So that's the split between kin and group, right?
They're fighting for a tribe, incidentally, worth fighting for. The United States of America, and they were above all, however, fighting for their little tribe, which was the band, the squad, the company. And when you ask Medal of Honor winners and other authentic heroes, military heroes, who they were, why they did what they did. Well, that they showed that extreme bravery. They said, for my brothers, for my fellow squad members, for the men that I was with.
And it's not their genetic family. It's this tribe we've been quite talking about.
Yeah, quite not.
Let me get Rick, thanks for the call. Let's see what Will from Chester County has to say. And Will, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you. I have sort of a two-part question, and my first actually leads right from what you were talking about. As far as the structure of the group individual tension, have you noticed that you have subgroups can sometimes sort of act in as individuals in relation to a larger group, or is it just that individuals keep living in multiple groups and the structure is entirely based around that?
Well, you know what, Will, hold on.
You just asked an hour's worth of answer. Yeah.
Hold on, Will. We'll get back to you for your second one.
Go ahead. First, I'll just say yes, of course. What you're just saying is a product of the Neolithic and the rise of modern social life and civilization is that we still have the group powerful tendency to form groups. As a social psychologist have said, it's an instinct that's so powerful that you can create on the spot arbitrary groups to play games against one another and very shortly have them identifying as a group and thinking the other group is inferior in some way. Well, that originates now within the larger groups. There's a hierarchy, and many of these groups are overlapping. So you, be rooting for your hometown football team with great vigor and emotion, but then you have lots of other groups that you might feel equally about under particular conditions of stress.
And Will, you had a second question?
Yes. I'm wondering to what extent the group individual dynamic explains how the presence and idea of a common enemy can be such a strong unifier, but only on a temporary and extremely fragile basis.
Another good question, Will. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Edward O. Wilson, go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, yeah. Yes, that's a very good point. Our groups tend to coalesce. You know, the subgroups tend to coalesce when there's a common enemy coming from a comparable coalition of groups or enemy of a sufficient magnitude, then we indeed gather. I think that's why we so enjoy these space alien invader movies. I do anyway. Suddenly you find, and Hollywood got that right, finally you find the nations gathered and all cooperating altruistically with one another when they have a common enemy. But we don't have anything quite comparable to that on this planet. So I don't think we'll ever come together like that.
Well, interesting. Will, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But just picking up on that point, I mean, there are those public events that, you know, whether it's the Super Bowl or, you know, Avatar, or I'm thinking of other public events that bring us all together.
It's part of our culture to respond like that, and cultures around the world as well.
And we're talking with E.O. Wilson today on Radio Times, and he's got a new book called The Social Conquest of Earth, and he's also a professor of, and let me get this correct here, he is a university research professor emeritus and honorary curator in entomology at Harvard University, the author of many, many books, including two that won a Pulitzer Prize, and he also has won other awards as well, and has spent his life exploring and understanding and doing research on ants. I'm Artie Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get Al from Bryn Mawr to join us, and Al, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi there.
First of all, it's an honor to speak with you. I'd like to ask a question about a book you wrote a while back, which I think put you on the map, Sociobiology.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you could go back in time, would you rewrite it such that the last chapter about human sociobiology would be held for another book, the same way Darwin decided not to speak about human evolution and his original origin of the species, simply because it was such a controversial subject.
That's a good question.
That's quite a keen observation. Yeah. You're quite right. Darwin held off publishing even the origin of species for a long time because he knew the controversy, the blowback, would be very effective harmful, he thought, to his family. But if I had to do it all over again, well, of course, I'd get it right this time, the genetic theory.
But I
want to point out in the passing, you know, that sociobiology is not the genetic theory. The genetic theory is just part of sociobiology. Sociobiology is a discipline. It's the systematic study of the biological origin of all forms of social behavior. And so it is, as it finally is coming to be clear, that's what it is. It's a discipline. It's not dependent on any particular hypothesis or theory on the genetic level. I would have got that right, of course, in that respect. So many things we could do and get them right if we could only go back in time.
Nice.
But I realize now I was pretty naive then. I didn't know I was going to get the enormous blowback from the social sciences and the political left, who at that time held to the blank slate theory. That is, that there is no such thing as a human nature or instinct or anything like that. And they thought that was a dangerous idea to entertain, that I would say something different. What I would have done, I think, if either I did write that second book, it was called On Human Nature. I got it published in 1978, and then I laid it out in full detail. And then it got a lot of acceptance. But if I had done it included in the first book, Sociobiology, I would have done it very much more cautiously.
Al, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Didn't someone dump a pitcher of water on your head for
something? I think I'm the only scientist in modern times ever to be physically assaulted because of an idea.
And it was because of that particular book?
Yeah. I'm rather proud of that. Maybe someone will step up and say...
Who dumped the water on you?
Well, it was a group of protesters over racism. And they thought, they bought into the argument, which is completely wrong, that sociobiology is intrinsically racist and would lead to racism. That was just a complete distortion of what the book is all about.
Let me get, looks like Nick from Westchester to join us on Radio Times. And Nick, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. As I hear you talking about different groups sort of competing against each other, whether by sports or even in war by race or religion or ethnicity, I'm curious if you could comment on how misogyny fits into all that, and basically thousands, if not millions, of years of male humans oppressing female humans.
Interesting question, Nick. Thanks for the call.
Right. Well, I guess in part because in most societies, females, the ladies haven't been able to form a tribe. But at any rate, no, I was just being...
I'm looking at you with shock on my face.
Well, feminism, the modern feminism movement, started really basically almost as a tribe because male dominance is a primate trait. Males tend, for reasons that we've succeeded in explaining in a lot of detail within sociobiology, males tend to compete and compete for dominant positions. And this often leads in stressed and simple societies, not always, because in hunter-gatherer societies you don't see it nearly as much, but as soon as we got more complex societies, it tended to emerge as a trait of male dominance.
But even just picking up on that, and this is using a broad generalization here, but if we're talking about group selection and the idea of altruism, women have been often described as being more cooperative, you know, less aggressive than men in those sort of broad biological categories. Do women, and if we're talking about altruism, would a group of women then beat, of altruistic women, beat a group of selfish men?
I think it probably depends on how the altruism is expressed. This is a tough one, and I'm going to get in deep water here.
I think you're going down.
All right, but men, when they express altruism, tend to do it in terms of the more aggressive behavior in joining in groups that then act in a more aggressive behavior with that kind of altruism within forming such a group manifest, whereas women tend to be more nurturing in their altruistic behavior. And they're capable of, course, at least great personal sacrifice as well as men, but they are expressing it in usually different mores, in different roles that they have tended to fall into throughout history.
Do you worry about the human species? Do you worry about us?
Of course I do. Anybody should. And we need, I've tried to make the point in many books that we really should make a better effort than we have of understanding ourselves, that is, the human species, developing a better self-understanding and a realistic understanding. I believe that the only way we can do that is through science, through a kind of extended science that brings in the best of the social sciences, humanities, and that we can get with this more exact and plain and realistic self-image, we'll be a better position to decide how to survive, and also, incidentally, to keep the rest of life alive, too, until we get through the bottleneck we're passing through in this century.
And again, and we're almost out of time here, but just and understanding these competing forces within the human species, within individuals.
Yes, we are. That's what we really are.
Chimera, yes?
Yes.
Edward O. Wilson, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. And his new book is The Social Conquest of Earth. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. For more information about the program, go to whyy.org/radiotimes. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. Thank you so much for joining us.